Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we will be talking with Dr. Martin Shapiro, Chief of General Internal Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, about balancing patient autonomy, all for one or one for all. Interesting questions.
Interesting questions. And we have some interesting research questions we're going to tackle. And let's dive into the very first one, Christy, about childhood asthma. And does it matter about its treatment if it becomes persistent? Because could it lead to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease as an adult?
Right. So this was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
I've heard of that journal.
Pretty good one. So, and they looked at 684 participants who were in this childhood asthma management program from ages 5 to 12 until they were at least 23 years old. So they followed them really over time to see what happened in relationship to having persistent childhood asthma, which is asthma and trouble breathing almost on a daily basis.
And basically, what they found is that if you have this persistent childhood asthma, that's really a strong predictor of developing chronic obstructive pulmonary disease later in life. Now, we know that active cigarette smoking is the number one cause of what's called COPD, this obstructive pulmonary disease. But other causes, including this one, persistent asthma that's not well controlled, is apparently a major cause. This, to me, is important information and perhaps something we don't appreciate when we're treating childhood asthma.
It is. I mean, they did find that early lung function predicts that lung growth later in life, regardless of their smoking exposure and treatment status. Yet, we know that if you have asthma and you smoke, you're far more likely to develop COPD, and that the treatments can really improve lung function and quality of life. So there are those elements that it's hard to tease out exactly chicken and the egg, but it says to me, as it does for you, that this group of children should really be encouraged to take the parents to take this seriously, to do everything they can to treat it appropriately, and to make sure that they approach it in partnership with their physicians.
Yeah, as my father of blessed memory used to say, let's talk tachas, which is a Yiddish word meaning let's get down and we're going to just go right down to the truth. And the truth here, when we're talking with people who sometimes have asthma and their parents are smoking, these kids and their parents are smoking, we think, you know, well, we want to prevent the pneumonia, we want to prevent the hospitalization. But the reality, what this research suggests, is we want to prevent them from developing what that person might have already developed, the parent might have already developed. So we've got to really talk tachas. We've got to have a serious conversation.
And at a young age, too, COPD at 23, that's significant. Okay, we're going to talk about something else that's significant and also related to children. So this is a 30-year study of families who are at high and low risk for depression, really looking at children of depressed parents and their risk of having adverse consequences or bad outcomes into adulthood.
Yeah, and this was a longitudinal study of 263 children from 91 families, and they followed them for over 30 years. And this was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry to really see to what extent those who perhaps were at higher risk for having depression as adults and those who they thought may be at low risk, and what impacts if the parents were depressed would have.
Yeah, and they did find that the offspring or the children of depressed parents have a higher risk for developing depression and having outcomes where they suffer that persist all the way until those children are in their middle age of life. So even though the major depression typically begins during their teenage years in both high and low risk individuals, those children with a family history are more likely to have recurrent episodes of depression and to have a harder time managing that depression as they grow up.
And these groups don't seem to differ in terms of whether they have jobs, what type of education, what type of income they have. But those who are high risk are more likely to be separated or divorced. But they certainly get more treatment for depression. They have more continuous treatment for other sorts of mental health conditions and worse overall functioning. So I think this is a risk factor. We, again, have to intervene early if we can, do our best to try to prevent longer-term issues as adults
for our children. Yeah, I mean, to treat the adults, to treat the parents, but also to pay special attention to those children who are at high risk.
Talk about adults. Our next research that matters has to do with telemedicine among Medicare beneficiaries. And we had a whole show on telemedicine, but we didn't focus specifically about our older patients on Medicare.
Yeah, so we know, and we've talked on the show, Adam, about the use of telemedicine with rural counties. So in places where people don't maybe have access to certain specialists or access to certain types of doctors, that telemedicine can be used really to extend, you know, to decrease that distance from the rural area to perhaps in a city where you may have those doctors. This was a study by Harvard Medical School that was also published in the Journal of the American Medical Association using Medicare claims data to follow and find that the use of telemedicine visits provided to these Medicare beneficiaries went up by 28% per year from the year 2004 to 2013.
Yeah, and they had over 100,000 visits in 2013. And it really begins to look at what types of patients are getting telemedicine. And more likely in these rural communities, over 40,000 rural Medicare beneficiaries got this in 2013. And it was those who had more likely to have mental illness, more likely to be sicker, more likely to be poorer than the average Medicare user, those who are more disabled. It means they're reaching those at higher risk, and that seems to be a good thing.
That's a good thing for sure. There's definitely some issues and barriers related to payment for telemedicine to be able to provide support and to provide coverage for patients to receive telemedicine from physicians that may be barriers to us moving this forward. But I think this is the direction we're headed. It's definitely, you know, one other piece of the puzzle to extend care into areas that don't have it.
We'll also have to look at the outcomes to make sure that the outcomes are at least as good. That's something important. And talk about our last outcome. This is actually looking to stimulate physical activity again among children, but obviously this involves their parents and this children-parent interaction.
So we know that there is an alarming rate of obesity in this country. We've talked about this several times on the show, Adam. And we also know that most kids are not getting enough physical activity. So this was a pilot study conducted at Massachusetts General Hospital, and it was published in the Journal of Adolescent Health, where they took kids who were overweight or obese and put them in different groups, but basically found that by encouraging them to increase their physical activity, not necessarily just through sports programs or taking classes, but through their everyday environment, like parks, playgrounds, jump rope, frisbee. Those kinds of things made a bigger impact.
Yeah, they actually wore a GPS device, which recorded their location, and they were showed where these parks and different areas they could access in their environment. And there were some different outcomes. This was only a pilot study. It was only at several months. But these outcomes appeared to be more physical activity, more engagement rather than less engagement. The question remains, can you replicate this on a larger scale? And can this actually be scaled to be used? Because we could throw these resources in there. But can we really have kids using GPS devices? Well, I think you could, because you've got a lot of kids have it.
Well, and the truth is, if we can prove and show that it's parks and playgrounds and everyday items that can help children build habits for a lifetime, well, that also helps us invest our resources in those community needs for every neighborhood and community to have access to these things that sadly is not totally available to everybody.
Agreed. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break, and when we return, Christy and I will be talking with Dr. Martin Shapiro, Chief of General Internal Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, about balancing patient autonomy, one for all or all for one. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Martin Shapiro, Chief of General Internal Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, about balancing patient autonomy, one for all or all for one.
Welcome, Dr. Shapiro. Thanks for being with us.
I'm happy to be with you.
Now, you are, as Adam said, Chief of General Internal Medicine at UCLA. Tell us how you became interested in your current field.
I think that I really became interested in internal medicine when I was a medical student, and my father was not receiving the best of care. He had a complex health problem, and his doctors weren't listening to him, and they weren't taking it seriously. And in the end, he died of complications of treatment, and that might have been avoided. And I decided I wanted to do a better job for people, and internal medicine seemed like a good field in which to go and to take on complex health problems and try to navigate on behalf of the patient in ways that were most consistent with promoting good health, listening to the patient's voice, and achieving an optimal outcome.
Well, you did your undergraduate medical education in Canada before, and even I think residency, before coming to the United States and becoming professor and the academia and research down at UCLA. So you've experienced both healthcare in the United States and Canada. Has that influenced how you think about healthcare?
It has. When I was a medical student in Montreal, the province of Quebec was just then adopting its universal health insurance program, and there was terror in the medical profession and a feeling that it would be the end of the world. The Canadian system was adopted in a way that provinces could opt in, and the federal government would cover half the cost of the program for those that did. So ultimately, of course, it put pressure on all the provinces to join. Quebec was a little late to the game, and the medical specialists in particular were intransigent. The family physicians were much more open and quickly achieved an arrangement with the government. The specialists actually went on strike, although the strike proved to be ineffective. Ultimately, of course, the system was adopted, and they did participate. And in not too many months, not only had the system not fallen into the abyss, but there was very wide acceptance and recognition that this was really a good thing for the population. So when I moved to the United States, this was in the late 70s, I assumed that the U.S. would soon follow. It's been a very long road.
Wow. Well, it's amazing that you have that perspective, and hopefully you're continuing to share that with the people around you. We're here to talk about this recent article you wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine, which tells the story of a dilemma that you faced on a flight with a patient. Could you please tell our listeners the story of this remarkable flight?
I was supervising on the inpatient service in our hospital, and we had a patient who was referred to us from the hematology-oncology service, who had acute leukemia that had been refractory to all treatment, and he was going to die. And he was very sick. He had pneumonia. He had blood in his urine. His platelet count in his blood was very low. He was requiring blood, red blood cell transfusions and platelet transfusions, oxygen, antibiotics, and everything else. And it was just a matter of time. There was nothing more that could be done to address his disease. He told me that he wanted to go home. And he was from France, from Paris, and I asked the residents to try to arrange that. And they did a wonderful job. There is a direct flight from Los Angeles to Paris on Air France, and Air France agreed to take the man as long as he was accompanied by a doctor and a nurse because of his condition. The residents weren't able to get time off to accompany him, and I was going off the service, so I went with him. We took along lots of medicines. We arranged to have supplemental oxygen. We had blood products since he was going to require transfusions at some point during the trip. So we were armed to the teeth. And there was a lot of concern because of the very low platelet count in his blood, generally below, well below 10,000, that with changes in cabin pressure, he could have an intracranial bleed. So we were worried about that, especially during takeoff. Well, the takeoff went pretty well. He was hyperventilating a little bit, but no change in consciousness, and things seemed like they were okay. It was hard to tell why he was breathing so rapidly, because it was pretty noisy on the plane. But not too long into the flight, the co-pilot came back to speak to me, and he said, we made a mistake. We didn't board enough oxygen to get to Paris. Would you like us to land in Chicago to pick up some more? Well, I wasn't sure what the best decision would be. Clearly, having the patient die for lack of oxygen on the flight was not something I wanted to see.
And were there other patients? Were there other people on this flight? Was this a commercial flight, or was this a special medical flight?
This was a commercial flight. This was a wide body plane.
Hmm.
We had, for him and his wife, me and the nurse, we had a block of four seats in the middle and three seats on one side, just to handle all of our stuff. But
wow.
The plane was relatively full, and as I'll indicate in a moment, there were some other unusual features of this flight. So I wasn't sure what to do, but there was another patient who was being transported on this flight. Quite unusual, but there it was. And this was a young woman in her early 20s who had connected in Los Angeles from Tahiti, which is, of course, a French department, where she had had a subarachnoid hemorrhage, and she was accompanied by a French doctor, and she was in a coma, and she was on a stretcher. They'd removed some seats to be able to put her effectively in a bed situation on the flight. So I was pondering what to do about my patients and whether we should land or whether we shouldn't land, and I decided I would ask the French doctor what he thought. So I went and spoke to him, and he looked at me, and he said, my patient's blood pressure was unstable when we landed and took off in Los Angeles. She has a small but real chance of long-term survival. Your patient is dying and has no chance of long-term survival. Landing in Chicago would be a great risk to my patient, and her needs need to take precedence over the needs of your patient. So that was really not what I expected to hear.
Wow.
But because all I had been thinking about was, well, what can I do for my patient? And what's going to give him the best outcome? And I wasn't thinking about what the implications were for anyone else, although I was aware that it would be an inconvenience to other passengers to make an extra stop.
Because
I thought about what he said, and I concluded that he was right, that it would be wrong to put his patient at risk in order to pick up some additional oxygen for my patient. So what I did was tell the co-pilot not to land in Chicago and we would take our chances. Now, as it happened, the crew were able to get permission to lower the plane's altitude to something like 28 or 29,000 feet, which improved the cabin pressure, and we didn't go through our oxygen as quickly as we might have. And in fact, we did run out of oxygen, but just as we landed in Paris, and we were able to get him to the hospital alive and he had an emotional reunion with his family. It was wonderful for him and for them. And he died 5 days later. So that's the story.
Wow. This raises so many important questions, mm-hmm. and we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, I think we would like to really kind of delve into the sorts of things that you were thinking about, not just about this case, but what this case means for the care that we all must think about in society and in healthcare. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Martin Shapiro, Chief of General Internal Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, about balancing patient autonomy, one for all or all for one. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Martin Shapiro, Chief of General Internal Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, about balancing patient autonomy, all for one or one for all. And you just relayed just an unbelievable story on an airplane related to two patients and making decisions both on behalf of your patient and also needing to consider what was in the interest of another patient on the plane. And tell us a bit about some of the issues that this has raised for you that then you went on to write an article about as you think about considering the common good and how this can apply to situations beyond that one airplane.
Well, this experience had a big effect on me, and I've continued to process it since then. But I was faced with a situation in which there was an explicit trade-off between the interests of one patient in the interests of another. It's something like what people might experience on a battlefield, who can you save? Or the sort of notion that you're somewhere and you don't have enough water or supplies for everyone to survive, and what do you do? But in medicine, the way it's practiced in the United States, where we spend 18% of our gross domestic product on health care, which is about 50% more than any other country, without better outcomes, and in fact with worse outcomes, we make decisions all the time, but the trade-offs between one patient and another are not explicit, they're implicit. So we do all kinds of things for people, and I think one of the things that contributes to it is the concept of autonomy and the real reluctance, for example, to not provide intensive care at the end of life endlessly unless all family members are in agreement and there isn't a threat of litigation. And this has implications for other people. You know, there might be other people who need that bed in the ICU and can't get it. The very fact of providing such care, and indeed a lot of what we currently call low-value care, drives up the cost of medical care. It makes it much more expensive for people to get health insurance, and the insurance they do get often has large deductibles, for which there's good evidence that it deters poorer people from getting the care that they need. We also have at least a two-class system in the United States, where poor people have been segregated into institutions and care systems that take care of very poor people, and quite apart from everyone else. And people tend not to think about those people, and they don't think about as a person, an individual makes the decision about their own health care. They think about what they want. They think of health care as a commodity, and they want to get their aliquot of the commodity. Doctors, too, don't think about a larger consideration very often of, is this a socially responsible thing for me to do? To do procedures or allocate scarce beds in a way that denies them to others or drives up the cost.
Well, don't we, in the interest of triaging, we seem to have a system in place that can say, when you come into the emergency room, if it's a wait, we take the sickest ones. When you do go to the intensive care unit, we push people out who someone makes a decision aren't quite as sick. But it seems as if that's still kind of closer to this autonomy, not a communitarian autonomy. Tell us what you're thinking about when you talk about kind of more the higher level you go when we have to make decisions that maybe aren't so acute, or is it only in the acute setting we have to make these decisions?
No, I mean, I think when we when people want MRIs of their back because their back's been aching for a few weeks, and doctors accede to those wishes and sometimes benefit financially from doing so. When other procedures are done, when there are certainly certainly your guidelines to suggest that you don't have to do that at a particular point. All of that adds to the cost of care. All of that ultimately makes care less accessible for others by so doing. So I think patient autonomy in a certain way is detrimental to the common good. I think the willingness of doctors to do procedures on willing patients also is detrimental to the common good. Mm-hmm. You know, the person will do a cardiac procedure with only two indications, lub and dub. Right?
Dr. Jack.
I recall the former chief of gastroenterology at our hospital lamenting what had become of his field, where people used to spend a lot of time talking to patients about their symptoms and trying to understand their disease. Whereas at the time I was talking to him, which was some years ago, he said now they exchange a few words and then schedule the procedure.
Right. Well, the other thing that occurred to me as you were talking is about the other people, getting back to the plane story, the other people on the plane. So given what they understood, if you had explained, we're flying at a lower altitude to lower the cabin pressure so that we don't need as much oxygen, I would imagine some people on that plane might think, well, why should we have less oxygen for this one patient? That there might be some people who may be misunderstanding the implications to them, might feel like, well, we should have, most of us aren't in this situation, we should have the best oxygen there is. And and the parallels to that in our modern medical world. Draw some of that, those parallels for us.
Well, I think in the plane case, in fact, the oxygen level in the cabin improved for everybody. By lowering the altitude.
But you wonder if some people might get that misinterpretation, just like people say, oh, well, if I want an MRI, then, and I need one because my back hurts, like maybe they don't, as patients don't fully understand
they might get worse care.
Risk, they might get worse care, actually. But as, you know, a lot of these factors are more complicated and people get misunderstandings of what it is and then feel like, well, wait a minute, we should get what we want, which goes back to that sort of autonomy and healthcare being a commodity versus these much more nuanced and complicated decisions.
Well, I would agree with you. I think that as a commodity, it's natural for people to want more of whatever they can get in our society, and the society encourages it. Indeed, I believe that, you know, the leading Republican candidate for president's platform is, I'm rich, you know, and this is what it's all about. I think that what's really needed is certainly a change in the attitude of physicians and to what their responsibilities are, you know, when they make decisions about whether and how to allocate resources. And clearly, the physicians are in a system that rewards them for not being more prudent. You know, even though, even with the advent of ACOs, affordable care organizations, or accountable care organizations, not yet affordable. I think most health systems are only doing that kind of resource management in the situations in which they have to. And as a more general philosophy, don't intend to do it until the last minute when they absolutely have to, and when they can stop squeezing every drop from the existing system.
So if you could leave our listeners with one final thought from a patient's point of view, what would you recommend?
I would say that getting more medical care is not always good. People get more medical care in the United States, and that is not always good. And deriving every bit of clinical resource from the system before you die should not be the goal. The goal should be to have a good life, to feel that, you know, very often at the end of life, people don't want to be a burden on their family, nor should the care that is given be a burden upon society when the evidence is lacking that this is meaningfully useful, that people should want the greatest good for the greatest number. And there are other health systems, and I gave the example of Canada, but there are many others in the developed world where everyone is in one boat, where the resources are common resources, and there's at least an incentive incentive to take into account the needs of the population as a whole when these resources are assigned. And it would be nice if that could happen in this country. That's no guarantee it will happen, because a change in the consciousness of people is also going to be necessary.
Right.
Systems, doctors, and the population as a whole will need to think about health and healthcare differently.
Sure.
Well, thank you for
raising these issues, for advocating for your patient, and then really considering more complex elements in that one situation, and then really making the effort to share that with people as we further our thinking about the common good. We've been talking with Dr. Martin Shapiro, Chief of General Internal Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, about patient autonomy. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
You can send any comments or questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd asked our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question today. Daniel.
I'm just 30 years old, but I've been dealing with pain for the last 10 years. It comes out of nowhere in multiple places in my lower back. I used to be a skateboarder and fell a lot, and one doctor told me that it might be arthritis. Physical therapy was not a relief for me, and I don't want to take painkillers, so what should I do?
Boy, this is a tough, tough question. And first off, we're sorry that you're having back pain at age 30, because that's not easy at any age, but I think even at younger ages, because you don't expect to have back pain, and then all of a sudden you got it.
And also, I would say you listed in your note that you don't want to start painkillers at age 30. And, you know, we can talk about some ideas of how to approach it, but I would agree with you that you're wise to be very cautious about starting any sort of opioid or narcotic pain medications at such a young age for something that's likely to be a problem for you on and off through life. We know those dangers are real. We've talked about that recently on the show, and you're wise to be wary of that. Let's talk about what else you can do.
I'm going to give two recommendations, and Chris can give two recommendations. We'll go back and forth and we'll see what we come
up with.
My first one is get a really good primary care doctor who can help you, be a captain with you, navigate with you, because you may need to see other specialists, and you need someone that's going to be with you, because I suspect this may be with you for a little while, too.
I would also recommend, if you're overweight, to really focus on thinking about nutrition and exercise, which is hard with your back hurting, but making sure that you're working towards a healthy weight.
I think sometimes we underestimate other practices that could actually help us in terms of breathing and meditation and mindfulness and yoga, how we perceive pain, how we deal with pain, how we can relax the muscles. I would approach this from a kind of a holistic viewpoint. A physician alone may not have all the answers.
Oh, man, that you took mine, Adam. And it's related to thinking of that team approach, thinking of acupuncture, going back to physical therapy, thinking about a trainer that maybe could help you come up with exercises that could strengthen the muscles of your stomach and your back, but really thinking about it in a comprehensive way. Good advice, Adam.
Certainly, we both could give medications, but we're looking to try to prevent and maybe do it without medication. So thanks for the question. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
My 5-week-old baby had a rectal temperature last night of 100.9, and we've had a virus going around the family recently. Do I need to bring her in if she's okay, except for the fever?
You know, that is a tricky one in some ways, in that in the first month of life, a fever in a baby is definitely, like, there is no doubt about that. That needs to come in. And we take that very seriously, because infants can get sick quickly and sometimes can have serious bacterial infections or bacterial in their blood and get sick very fast. With 5 weeks old, you may hear people say, oh, it's not as important, they're beyond that window. But in fact, I would recommend that you bring your baby in. You can't just assume it's that virus. And having a physician and her primary care doctor examine her, potentially take some blood work and really investigate where the fever is coming from is really important.
Yeah, I'd want to see the child.
Yep.
And also I'd want to replicate, see what the fever actually is, because sometimes it may or may not be that way when we get to the doctor. It could be higher, it could be lower. This is not one I'd want to do telemedicine on.
Right. Well, and the other thing I'd say
is, video medicine. Yeah.
You know, we really worry about these fevers in infants, and then babies get older and they're like 2 or 3 or 4 years old, and parents are like, well, my baby has a fever, I got to bring her to the ER. And as the babies get older, you know, we have a little more time to sort it out. Often it is a virus. Still, the doctor can examine you, but when they're so little, it can be a little deceiving. They can get sick fast. So I do think bringing them in and taking that fever seriously when they're very little is a little bit of a different scenario than when they're a little bit older. We still need to get checked out, but not quite as urgent.
Great. Daniel, what's our next house call?
I'm having really intense anxiety about the presidential election. I recently had a cleansing with Ayurvedic medicine, and I feel a lot better. Have you heard of this treatment before?
Well, this is a great question. We don't know which intense feelings about which candidate within the election, or candidates, we should say. And perhaps the cleansing could be a spiritual cleansing as well as a physical cleansing. In this case, could be physical. I think all of us could perhaps use some deep breathing about the presidential election and recognize that we'll probably be okay. But deep breathing is good.
Right, right. And it's hard to know, as you mentioned, Ayurvedic medicine, what exactly you took and what that is. Adam, I don't think I've ever told you this, but I went to India one time when I was a medical student and studied with a doctor who did, you know, this type of medicine and healing. And it was really eye-opening to see different ways of thinking about health. And my mind is open to those things sometimes being helpful. It's hard to know if what it was that you took or did in that category to help you feel better, but I'm really glad that it worked. It seemed to be making progress. And I would encourage you to really think about your wellness, your sleep, and the different things that help you feel well during this time of what's probably going to be more stress to come if these kinds of things are upsetting.
Yeah, I think some spiritual cleansing, regardless, is good for us in these presidential elections and times in which violence seems to be the recourse, and I wholly reject. So thanks so much for the question. Daniel, what's our last house call?
I think my 5-year-old has a UTI, a urinary tract infection. She says it stings inside her bottom when she pees, and I felt her lower back, and she says it doesn't hurt when I touch there. My insurance recently changed, and I can't take her to our normal doctor, so what should I do? Will it go away on its own, or should we go to urgent care?
Well, we don't have a lot of time, but Christy, what are your quick thoughts?
Well, my quick thoughts is that a real urinary infection doesn't go away by itself. Like, you know, if she's got a UTI, as you say, then she needs an antibiotic. That being said, the only way to really know, and sometimes little girls, it's hard to get the symptoms right, is to bring her in somewhere to a clinic or a health center or somewhere that you can afford and get that urine checked out and make that decision of does she need an antibiotic or not.
Sometimes I think if she doesn't have a fever, she's not vomiting, it might be okay to wait a day, and a lot of times those things could resolve too. So we know it's not an easy situation, but thank you for that question. Thank you for all of the questions today on your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can always send us your own questions or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Martin Shapiro. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.